We're spending the next 3 weeks in Utopia in the company of a group of people at the start of the 20th century. When they look around them, they see an ever-expanding frontier, not only in technology, inventiveness, progress, but in human perfectibility, justice, the structure of society. They've been witness to an extraordinary transformation of the human condition, and they believe it's going to continue. We're going to explore one specific utopia, a shared fantasy known as the Glass Paradise, and its inventors, Paul Schierbart and Bruno Taut. We're going to start at a moment. It's the moment when the dream comes closest, when it touches reality in the form of a building, before tracing its route up to that point, and in future episodes, exploring what happened afterwards to Taut, Schierbart and his circle. And we're going to experience the building in the company of Norbert Keflin, 43, representative of manganese bronze castings AG of Düsseldorf, halfway over the broad brown Rhine, 20 minutes too early because he didn't trust the affable Kerner to run a reliable train service, and now walking in the cool May morning towards the entrance of the Deutsche Weltbund exhibition, laid out in broad park, curving away down the Rhine to his left. He has the impression, not inaccurate, that the offer of attending was a kind of consolation for being passed over again for chief assistant. He felt no relish at the prospect. He had never liked Cologne, perhaps a feeling that the water this far down had passed through too many kidneys, and was puzzled why Herr Braun, an otherwise steady and reasonable man, wouldn't have signed off on it. The lavish expense of these kinds of exhibition was frivolous, an understandable extravagance, but one that he nevertheless considered that a prudent manager should have been capable of resisting. The sound of knocking echoes from the closed fairground, and the sun emerges from behind the morning clouds. 20 minutes is an awkward interval of time, but he supposed that in the shopping arcade a selection of diverting new materials might be on display. Frau Keffling had made more than one request for a new divan cover, he recalled, and might become unreasonable if the matter were left unaddressed too long. Something on the avenue ahead of him is reflecting the sun. Shielding his eyes, he finds himself looking at a very strange structure. Like a pine cone, he thinks, or a crystal, cut glass. Closer, he realizes how large it is, a pointed glass dome with a constellation of big glass balls around it, like tiny planets around a sun. The light of the sun is reflected all around him. He's standing still. His head feels suddenly empty. Up on the side of the dome, he reads an epigram in bold, unserifed letters. Glass plate destroys hate. The staircase is in front of him, and one halting step at a time, he's drawn inside. You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities.
I'm Luke Jones.
And I'm George Gingell.
And we're talking about one of the great curiosities of the early 20th century, the Glass House, designed by Bruno Taut for the German Association of Glass Manufacturers. It's remarkable not just for what it is, a love letter to a material and a technology, but also for where it comes from, arguably the first building in history to begin as a work of science fiction, or fantasy, as they called it. The story we're telling today is two interlinked stories. There's a story of a building, and preceding it, the story of a dream, the Glass Paradise. And at the same time, it's the story of two people. There's Taut, the architect, hyperactive, charismatic, widely admired, and the man who he called Glasspapa, the writer Paul Schierbart, who was part barfly, part holy fool, who in his fantasies imagined a planet studded with shining glass cities and a society transformed by beauty. George, we're tackling this across several episodes, because it's a story which has sort of several chapters. And in a way, we're starting at the end of the first chapter.
We're starting at the end because it's a building, a rare physical product. You've situated it in science fiction, which would be the science fiction of Jules Verne. The Weltbund exhibition came at the pinnacle and sort of last moment of the great German half century leading up to it, which had seen the nation transform from a rural backwater. One of the people love it when people say things which turn out to be really historically wrong, right? You know, by the year 1990, instead of the world requiring 5 computers taking up 3 rooms each, it will require 10 taking up 2 rooms each, or whatever. And one of those historical inaccuracies is, you know, said in sort of about Germany in 1850, the Germans are a quiet and peaceful folk, more prone to art and poetry. Unfortunately, they can never do anything in the business of war industry. It turned out they were wrong. But it had been, well, it had been quite a lot of war up to this point, but the sort of war that people quite like, the sort of decisive, brief, successful war. And Germany had gone from this patchwork of little states and kinglets and pumpernickels and, you know, sort of joke principalities to being the Second Reich in all its pomp and fury, technological innovators, probably decades ahead of Britain and even the United States, every marvel of modern convenience, gyroscopic, single-wheeled electric trains, double glazing, aspirin, chemical ingenuity, education that is not exclusively based on the church, maybe the idea of scientific experimentation, liberal development, social housing.
And something unfortunate is about to happen. We haven't said what year it is.
It's 1914.
Everyone is in for a bit of a shock.
Yeah, it's going to come to an end. It's very easy to forget how sophisticated the culture was that invaded France, rather excitingly, in August of that year.
In the mind of its architect, and I think that this is something which we would probably broadly concur with, this building is kind of a model of utopia. It's like a little microcosm of this much larger sort of idealistic vision. And it was a model of how new materials and technology might actually transform the relationship between people, nations, their environments, the universe, certainly the planet, and all through the use of glass and the significance and kind of symbolic.
And it was an easy time to have that. It's coming out of the 19th century, which is a century, and the early 20th century, when man's relationship to his environments was radically changed by new materials and technology. The world did shrink at an ever-giddying pace for more or less the first time. And many people commented on this. What you were calling science fiction wasn't the same sort of science fiction that we have today, because it seemed much more plausible, and it seemed plausible for the first time, that the world was radically changing, and people seriously considered these flights of fancy as speculations into what, and thought experiments around what the future could be like. Not in every literal sense. It's a vessel into which you could put whatever your crackpot philosophy of the day was. And in a sense, we are looking at this one because it's a very interesting crackpot philosophy, and also because it had real architectural output, which the others didn't. The Wizard of Oz, no one made the Emerald City. No one tried to make the Emerald City, to the best of my knowledge. Please tell me if I'm wrong. I'd love to know.
But
they did
make the Glass Paradise.
They did try and make the Glass Paradise.
Should we return to the Rhine Park and explore the building?
So we're there. It's a nice sunny May morning.
Yeah.
We've just come in from the train station and walked down and seen this thing standing in the middle of the causeway out to the park. And in front of us, beyond the pavilion, is the fair with its industrial buildings, peculiar, interesting. It's a great time. I mean, this pavilion is a really interesting and unusual, but there were a number of really interesting, peculiar. There was this flowering of pavilion architecture at that point in a direction which has never really come back, or like an efflorescence of sort of beautiful and strange and enigmatic things that have gone away. And hopefully, over the next few episodes, we will tackle some of that. He is surrounded by light. The walls are glowing, crystal banks of colour. Every surface is glittering. Even, he realises, the floor, big milky circles of cast glass underfoot. The technology is extraordinary, he thinks, unsure of where to look. Inside, a set of vitrines are samples of the Deutsche Luxfer Prismen Syndikat. Blocks, some vases, and other things. The brightness in direct sunlight was wonderful. Passing cloud becomes a flurry of little shadows on the interior. The light seems to melt and then solidify. Through a circular opening in the centre, he notices the sound of rushing water. Down another stair, he enters a crystal grotto, the pearly glimmer of mosaic. The walls around him are glowing images, stained glass of flowers and trees, the cascading water, a miraculous fountain down between iridescent walls. In the darkness at the bottom, a kaleidoscopic screen where light plays and pirouettes. The colours and images play across the rippling pools. It is like a slow, inexpressible dream. He does his best to run to the appointment he is now late for, stumbling out of the darkness, arriving, puffing and blowing, 10 minutes late, is greeted by polite silence. Later, when a thin Saxon is explaining the potential of spin-cast chrome alloy die sets, he finds his attention caught by the dapple light passing through the frosted panels of the main hall and playing on the distant wall. He becomes aware of silence. He's failed to answer the question. He shakes his head. Yeah, it's a strange building and a difficult one to describe, unlike all the other buildings, which are really easy to describe in the medium of radio. It's one of our slight difficulties. But I think if a sort of educated person looked at it who had no idea of what it was, you would know it had some sort of relationship to kitsch Hollywood Art Deco. The going up the polished staircase, which has got water flowing down it on either side, the funny golden orbs, rotating lights, it's sort of Busby Berkeley finest. But it also has these strange avant-gardist, stark, strong and strange characteristics that point to it belonging to an earlier age.
There's one of the things I like about it is the quality of lateral thinking in how many different types of glass can go into it. It's definitely the brief to sort of exhibit all of the potential as glasses.
We haven't said this, material. But it's paid for by the German Association of Glass Manufacturers. I mean, this guy has been putting out weird propaganda about the future of glass, but then these people who actually have the business of selling various sort of products, tiles, mosaics, glass bricks.
They're all in there and they're it more or less hangs together.
It's sort of, I think it would have been wonderful. We are exploring it entirely through the very slight collection of black and white photographs of a building which is known principally for its vibrant colour and also for its dynamic water rushing noises and things not present to us here.
Yeah, there's some parts of it, so the colour is completely absent. The kaleidoscope, which was a projection experience which inhabited part of the space, is completely, obviously it didn't photograph very well.
Yeah, and I can imagine it not. If you think of the Russian kaleidoscope or animated light images that came on a little bit later, or the sort of proto Bauhaus post-war ones, it's sort of dots and flashes and oil slides and moves, and that on its own is just a circle on a screen.
I'm not sure. I think maybe we should just go through it in a slightly more kind of technical way. There's a few key things. One is that the dome has two layers. That there's this outer layer of diamond-shaped panes of glass, and there's this inner thing which is lots and lots of little.
It's made of coloured glass bricks, which were a new-ish invention, and people hadn't quite worked out what they meant. And so there's something we now sort of associate with the front of Art Deco period factories, but he's making it into a Gothic thing, Gothic dome. It has more Fabergé egg. It's got that complex shape that is described. It's not a simple sort of curve. It's a kind of going to a tip made of three or four. It's one that takes a bit of draftsmanship to draw. It's not a cut circle or a paraboloid or a. You can see all over it the work of hands. It hasn't yet, although it is an exhibition of industrial products. Everywhere in it you can see handwork. All the joints are sort of smoothed and polished in a handmade kind of way. The writing isn't. It feels like someone's cut out the shapes and cast them into the concrete by hand. even though it's this crisp, sans-serifed, modern sort of font, it still feels like it has a connection back to William Morris. But then at the same time, if I'm looking at the inside, it has a load of sort of symbols which are going to be mined in sci-fi for years to come. This funny globed light made of sort of, they look like kind of fish eyes bubbling out of a central core or something dragged from the murky depth. These sort of funny ornamental triangles with discs and spinning lights which feel like they could be somewhere on the drive desk console of a UFO. But back to the building. I'm not sure if we've described it, really.
It's very hard, isn't it? I've tried sort of sense impressions, but what do you see if you're standing outside it?
So, the first thing is, I'm going to describe the background first, which is that it's obviously the trade fair, and you can tell it's a pavilion at the front. It's this object building. It's quite big for a simple pavilion. So, it's 15 metres wide at its base. So it's probably 19, getting on for a bit under 20 metres tall, or maybe even a little more than 20 metres tall.
Yeah, I never, it's much bigger than I...
It looks quite big to me, it's quite a big pavilion. This is not your sort of, if people know the Serpentine pavilions, in, it's grander than that, it's a real big industrial product. I mean, it's a nice little callback that these sort of started with the Great Exhibition, 1853, is it? 52? 52, which is this amazing British Empire and world, and the Crystal Palace is made, this huge, first massive glass building. And after then, the English have never really shown any interest in it at all, although that was regarded as a great success. And it went into continental Europe, and there were a series of expos, Paris, the Eiffel Tower was built for one. It's got those three components, but the whole thing, yeah, it looks like an acorn coming up out of the ground. The bottom, it's got this big plinth, which is 5 metres tall. I don't think it can be 5 metres tall, but it's probably three or something. Yeah. On that stands the raised base and the dome, which is made of these diamonds of plate glass, and you can sort of see through the diamonds of plate glass that inside is a filigree of coloured blocks. There's the downstairs, and everywhere you are when you're on the inside, you're surrounded by hundreds of different kinds of glass. There'll be a wall of glass blocks, which will have glass patterning, glass tiles, bright colours on the floor, reflecting water. You look up into the ceiling, and there are these cylinders of glass going up to the room above, letting in presumably coloured light, and you're able, would probably be able to see the footsteps of the people above you. There's semi, it's sort of semi-transparent, translucent, distorting the image. Yeah. You go upstairs, there's a few exhibition stands under this amazing polychrome dome. And in fact, downstairs is full of stained glass as well. There's all these panels of sort of modernist stained glass set into the walls. Upstairs, it's got that feel too. And these amazing lanterns. And then you go back down again into the kaleidoscope, which we've got very little to say about.
Except it was presumably
it was must have been
jolly.
Absolutely amazing. Must have been amazing. It's yeah, it's a shame they hadn't got onto psychedelics earlier.
At the same time that the building was being opened, Tout released a little pamphlet on the subject of the glass house and also setting out its aims and its purpose. I'm going to read just a tiny bit of that. The glass house has no purpose other than to be beautiful. It is intended purely as a structure for exhibition and should be a beautiful source of ideas for a lasting architecture. According to the poet Paul Schierbart, to whom it is dedicated, the glass house should inspire the dissolution of current architecture's far too restricted understanding of space and should introduce the effects and possibilities of glass into the world of architecture. May it, in its own way, help to foster a transformation of building towards the light and grace that it currently sorely lacks. The glass house illustrates the architectural possibilities that lie hidden in glass. He also presages the pamphlet with a little quotation from one of Schierbart's own works, which goes like this. We live for the most part in closed rooms. These form the environment from which our culture grows. Our culture is to a certain extent the product of our architecture. If we want our culture to rise to a higher level, we are obliged, for better or worse, to change our architecture, and this only becomes possible if we take away the closed character from the rooms in which we live. We can only do that by introducing glass architecture, which lets in the light of the sun, the moon, and the stars, not merely through a few windows, but through every possible wall, which will be made entirely of glass, of coloured glass. The new environment which we thus create must bring us a new culture.
We haven't got on really to Schierbart yet, but he is the originating spirit of not only the idea of glass architecture, but a lot of its peculiarities and particularities.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just to finish off on the pavilion, he's definitely serving two masters, Tout. He's doing a very good job for the German Association of Glassmakers, but he's got his eyes on something bigger.
Yeah, and I think the way he manages to combine them is that they are all about how wonderful glass is, and his bigger idea is that glass not only can a beautiful pavilion with lots of glassworks in it transform the selling environment for various glasswares of industrial production, but it can also transform the human spirit and lead humanity into an ecstatic divine future. Two interesting and not necessarily conflicting ideas. If people have been to tech conferences, often you often hear sort of insane futures for seemingly rather banal technological products.
Yeah, well, we've got to Schierbart, haven't we? Glass Papa.
And he's the sort of origin. He's a sci-fi writer, but not in any way that you would recognise. Maybe a drunk?
Yes, he's definitely a drunk.
He's a recognisable drunk.
I've been reading a bit too much, but maybe I'll do like a little paragraph from this essay about him, which sums up.
Yeah, he's an amazing figure with an amazing life.
This is an essay by Christopher Turner. In the book, which I highly recommend, Glass, Love, Perpetual Motion. That has 6 exclamation marks in the title.
It's 1 for the first thing, 2 for the second, and 3 for the third. It also has a good pattern of
a Paul Schierbart reader.
It's probably where 60% of the content, probably pessimistic, of this episode comes from.
So here it goes. Paul Schierbart was born in Danzig in 1863, the 11th child of a well-to-do merchant. His early life was marred by tragedy. His mother died when he was 4. He lost his father aged 10. And all his siblings had died by the time he was 16. Little else is known about his early days. Having failed to complete his education, he moved to Berlin in 1887, hoping to make a career as a writer. He lived there for the rest of his life in bohemian chaos and near starvation, publishing books and writing journalism on crime, politics, and culture. The Polish symbolist Stanisław Przybyszewski once said that Schierbart would have walked the streets of Berlin naked had it not been for the generosity of a friend who gave him clothes inherited from an uncle. Schierbart's emaciated frame was often swamped in an antique frock coat, several sizes too big, with sleeves so long that they hid his knuckles.
Well, blah, 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 blah. And the other things about him is that he spends his life swanning around bars and cafes, writing delirious fiction and propositions that nobody really buys, but I suppose influence a few people. All I can say is he must have been bloody charismatic for this to work, because he seems like one of those people when once you've taken him away in the cold light of history, it doesn't really seem to add up.
It's very hard to really imagine how his kind of magnetism, which must have been very profound. There's a story somewhere in this book of his 50th birthday, which was in an unheated room. Everyone was sitting on crates of oranges because he had no furniture. And among the guests were not only the chief of police, but also a number of prominent gangsters. And they were all there together, like, reveling with him.
The only clue we have to how this kind of worked is the strange joy and pleasure of reading his completely bonkers writings. This sort of delirious, playful joy that you can get out of... I can see why they didn't sell, but there's something lovely and youthful and lifeful in his mad, erratic statements. The sort of speed and levity with which he rattles them off.
The trajectory of his life is, like, something very remarkable.
Yeah, so he's born in the Kingdom of Prussia, in Danzig, which is now... like halfway along the Polish border, but there was an awful lot more Prussia to go east of that.
Present day
and in
Gdansk.
Fact, Bruno Tout is born in what is now Kaliningrad, which is Russian. That's how far Germany went. He's got this incredibly tragic childhood, which reminds you that we're not in modernity yet in the mid-19th century in Germany. We're still in the age of pestilence and unenlightened catastrophe. Moves to Berlin, and over the course of the time he's there, it grows in size fourfold. We go from a fundamentally rural, agricultural, an agrarian world to a world of buzzing lights and technology, and he's watching it. And that the possibility of this transformation is what I think makes the whole thing plausible. People have seen the world change completely. You know, something like the sort of experience of people who grew up in Korea after the war. They went from living in huts with straw roofs to being in Korea now, this high-tech society, the most high-tech in the world. It's maybe not quite that extreme, but it's very nearly that extreme. Yeah. And he's in Berlin, which is not a typical place. It is the imperial capital. So while what has made it possible is the Rhineland with its belching factories, it was never a really industrial place. It was a hugely booming city because it was the capital of this great and growing empire. And it is full of these bombastic, portentous monuments. The road, sufficiently wide, unter den Linden, 40 horsemen can ride abreast down. And that's what it's for. And people, I'm sure, have been to Berlin, and the sort of sense of like a few hipsters rattling around these terrific broad streets and the shattered monuments. Well, all those shattered monuments that are sort of so brilliantly kind of picked out in their blown upness, they're built in this time. But also the railways, these lattices of steel, rivets, speed, which cut straight through the centre. And you've got that idea of modernity and bombastic imperialism, cheek by jowl.
So in 1892, he inherited some money, and what that meant was that he could write the things that he really wanted to write and publish them himself. But he has this encounter which changes everything for him, where he has the great good sense to marry his landlady, which means that he has a permanent place to live, and he...
You've always got to make one sensible decision in your life. I also get the sense that she might have been the only thing keeping him alive by sort of bullying him into being sporadically less insane.
We're getting so off topic. He apparently used to refer to her as the bear.
Yeah. What was the other thing? Something even worse.
A female Sancho Panza.
The female Sancho Panza. What does that mean?
Yeah. I don't know.
I get the sense of like her being the rails. Anyway.
The other thing which happens is that they come to be living in Dahlem, which is where the botanical gardens are, and he sees all these amazing glass houses, and all this stuff kind of comes out of there. So he...
I'm sure some people would have been to wherever you are. There's, you know, here it's Kew. Yeah. And in the mid and early 19th century, they built these amazing palm houses, which are the first big glass structures in the world, with the tropics inside them. And they're sort of doubly magical places. Going there as a child, they felt magical because at once there are these sort of lovely, exotic, organic shapes, curved glass and iron and very light structures and these beautiful cast iron stairs and things. But also they're full of a jungle. And you go in under these steely grey skies of suburban London, or Berlin, which also has pretty steely grey suburban skies, and you suddenly enter paradise. There's, you know, tweeting tropical birds, and you can see how these would inspire someone with a sense of magic and wonder.
So the books are, as they go on, they coalesce around this idea of glass. Should we read a little bit of some? They have, like, really, the tone is very strange.
It's delirious. They're amazing. Yeah. We always come back to delirious sci-fi, don't we? Because you said the first thing to be put by sci-fi, and I immediately thought, hang on, we've only done like 6 episodes, and we've already done another one, which is Strawberry Hill, which is
kind of
like,
yeah,
another building built out of sci-fi, yeah, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly, yeah, kind of fantasy. The books are speculative, they're strange. This is kind of hard, because I think things probably read a bit differently in German, but they have this strange sort of ironic distance. I think that they're often satirical, but they're very dry in a way as well. So here's, shall I read a little bit from, this is from the end of a story called 1901, A Novel of the Future. A novelette of the future, which is 3 pages long. And the story is that this young man gets arrested for not having enough money. You need to have 30 days worth of money with you in cash at all times in the future. This is the strange...
Do you get the sense that he might have been hassled by the Berlin authorities on account of being passed out, pissed on the street, penniless, in like with holes through his shoes, and people suggesting that he might have been a vagrant? It does seem like something that could possibly have happened. Yeah. Anyway.
So the characters in this are Friedrich Schumm, who's the young man who doesn't have enough money, and Adolphine Beisel, who's a sort of spoilt rich girl who nevertheless rather likes him and sees him being arrested out of the window at the start of the story. Gentlemen, I think you have all truly lost your minds. Luckily for Defendant Schumm, after he says these words, another revolution breaks out in the streets. The magistrate and the judges immediately run home, and the public prosecutor and the other officials follow suit. Schumm sits in the dock, dumbfounded. He is now completely alone in the courtroom, truly alone, forgotten. He has no idea what to do. Meanwhile, the revolution proceeds purposefully and according to plan. Later, Schumm crouches down in the dock, since the revolutionary's bullets whiz through only the upper part of the courtroom. Meanwhile, Adolphine Beisel thinks kindly of her beloved Friedrich. She forgives him inwardly and returns to blowing on her harmonica. She finds this August revolution just as boring as the previous April one.
Yeah, so you get a sense that he might not be taking things like coherence, logic, and making any sense particularly seriously, or also probably being commercial.
Yeah.
Which is why I was a bit interested in what he could have possibly written for money.
I think he really
struggled at that.
He struggled. So the around the time of the Pavilion, you know, everything sort of comes together, and this fascination with glass becomes all-consuming. And there are two books which he published in 1914, the year of the Pavilion. One is a novel, which is probably his most interesting novel, The Grey Cloth and 10% White, and a manifesto for architecture called Glass Architecture. I think we're going to talk about the novel quickly. Shall I give you a little sort of précis of it?
Yeah.
It's the story of Herr Krug, an eccentric industrialist and sort of star architect, and
he's great as a character because he sort of presages so many of the silly, he kind of satires before it's happened so many of the things that are going to happen now with star architects.
Yeah, and actually it's really told from the perspective of his wife, who is this kind of clever woman who he propositions and who he gives one request to, which is that she should always wear the same kind of dress that she was wearing when he first became attracted to her, which is grey with 10% white. And there's a reason for this, which is that it perfectly complements the extravagant and beautiful colours of his glass architecture.
And in fact, there's a quite nice bit of the story, which is that she humours him throughout, and through her reasonableness, his absurdity is continually brought up.
Yes.
He sort of swans around the world making these preposterous buildings one after another, which is the sort of thing... But the preposterous buildings that he's proposing are exactly the buildings he's proposing seriously in his serious book. He's able to... Architects have a nice tradition of proposing sort of fascist worlds in which they rule everything, and why can't everyone do exactly as I say? He does that, but he also then takes the piss out of himself for doing it, which makes it infinitely more acceptable. Do you want to go give a review as a novel? What's it got on Goodreads? I've got fascinated with... I looked up Samson Antigonistes. Agonistes. Yeah. Samson Agonistes on Goodreads and discovered that it's got the equivalent of 7 out of 10, which is 3.5 stars. I thought, it's amazing. So what's it got?
It's got 3.4.
It's exactly the same. 7 out of 10.
Do you want me to read a review?
Yeah.
They're actually quite good reviews. Herr Krug, a world-famous architect of the future, obsessed with coloured glass, wed Frau Clara, a rather modern organist, on the condition, mentioned in their marriage contract, that she should wear exclusively clothing in grey with a 10% highlight of white. Haunted by the fear of being objectified by her new husband, Clara persistently questions the single rule established by her Herr Krug and increasingly resents what amounts to a gagging order. Unfortunately, the uptight and easy slapstick has not aged so well and converged with the lavish settings and ubiquitous descriptions of a lavish lifestyle to emphasise the historical distance that separates us from the intended readers.
I think that last bit is problematic because I think at the time people would have felt pretty blooming distanced from it.
Yeah.
He writes about plutocrats.
Yeah, they're all like super wealthy,
like real plutocrats in sort of, is it like Commedia dell'arte or something like that? Like this adult pantomime, like it would be some sort of puppet show.
Interesting, and actually, I think quite unusual about Schierbart. He is simultaneously like a utopian who is being critical about the sort of totalitarian side of utopia.
And kind of unabashed totalitarian as well. There's like dictator. And the book is about subverting and taking the piss out of his dictatorial characteristics.
So he kind of roams the world, like he's putting these, you know, he was like, okay, we'll put one on top, we'll put like a glass opera house on top of that mountain.
And what's nice about this is the logical conclusion of the architectural manifesto that he'd just written. And I think this one comes out just afterwards, doesn't it?
I don't know, they're around the same time. So we should talk about the manifesto, which is like one of the strangest architectural manifestos you'll ever read. Less for the outlandishness.
And actually, they tend to be pretty odd.
Yeah, it's less for the outlandishness of what it proposes than for its curious attention to the minutiae of details within that kind of crazy thought world. Let me just outline what he's talking about. He's talking about a technological utopia where all architecture has become glass architecture.
Well, it's not it's proposing that this should happen and is the right thing.
Yeah.
It's advocating for it.
Glass is everywhere. Old-fashioned materials like brick have been replaced with ferroconcrete and steel.
And where you have to have ferroconcrete and steel, it's probably covered in, like, engraved, enamelled filigree covered in gold.
I think we have to try and describe what this world is like. Every building is a sort of huge volume, a bit like the dome of the glass house, I think.
On the outside, they glow like glowing crystals with lights in the middle of their cavity glass walls, casting colour on the whole world around them.
And they're kind of overwhelmingly visual. Everything which isn't coloured is reflective.
And the colours aren't sort of broad blocks of colour. They're kaleidoscopic patterns of colour.
And this is everything. So this is, you might have smaller ones, which are kind of little houses. There are bigger ones, which could be kind of public buildings.
Or dockyards, military bases, lighthouses, sports grounds. All of these are addressed. There's a whole section of it which is basically saying, and here's another kind of building. It would benefit too.
And they are also have like this completely new relationship to landscape where they just kind of pop up everywhere. They kind of take over the Alps.
The mountains will be lit up and coloured at night. Anything that could burn or degrade is removed. And anything that would interfere with these kaleidoscopic glass walls is taken away. All the furniture is piled up in the middle of the room. Nature is allowed in, but insects are sucked up with giant vacuum cleaners.
One of the things that you get reading it is this sense of like an intensely impractical man trying to design a like technological system, and one of his great sort of invention is this idea of the double glass wall, that you have an outer wall and an inner wall, and this is something like double glazing which he's imagining, but with this additional properties: first, that there's a sort of interstitial space between the two of them which can be inhabited with different uses, and also that these two layers can be different colors which play against each other to create some kind of impression.
Also, the reason, I think, the biggest reason for his double glass wall is that he's been to these palm houses, which are amazing utopic spaces, and he sees that the main problem with them is that you have to heat them. And he thinks that if it's a glass house with a double wall is warm in the winter and cold in the summer.
Should we do some fun quotations?
Yep.
So we heard the one at the start about how the glass is going to transform society. So here's one. 18. The beauty of the earth when glass architecture is everywhere. The face of the earth would be much altered if brick architecture were ousted everywhere by glass architecture. It would be as if the earth were adorned with sparkling jewels and enamels. Such glory is unimaginable. All over the world it would be as splendid as in the gardens of the Arabian Nights. We should then have a paradise on earth, and no need to watch in longing expectation for the paradise in heaven.
Strong stuff. Something we haven't said is that the book consists entirely of numbered propositions. A little over 100. And they're very repetitious.
Here's another one. 17. Glass fibres in applied art. It has been forgotten by many that glass can be developed as fibres which can be spun. The story goes back more than 40 years, perhaps further. I am not sure. These glass fibres may lead to a whole new industry in applied art. Divan covers, chair arms, etc. can be made of them.
Yeah, he loves glass fibres. Glass fibres come up again and again and again, but he has no idea. They're going to be used. Glass fibres are going to be used to make the new permanent flooring. It's a replacement for carpet. It's like carpet that never wears out, made of fibreglass.
Yeah, fun story. Someone I know, when they were young and inexperienced at life and living on their own, they and a group of friends found some glass fibre insulation, which is lovely fluffy stuff. And they took it home and they like played with it and threw it around and had it in their beds and all this kind of stuff. And after a while, they found that they were very itchy. And because, of course, it's like intensely irritating to the skin.
It gradually permeates into your skin and like wheedles around, damaging everything around it. It's like the most pernicious and awful set of little spines and splinters.
There was a fun moment when the doctor told them that they would have to clean their entire flat with masking tape.
How did that go?
I don't know. I didn't like that was the end of the story, which I've stolen.
We've got to have read a few more of them. Some of them are so extraordinary.
Here's one. 34. The vacuum cleaner in the park too, also as an insect exterminator. In the near future, the vacuum cleaner will seem as important as main water and will be used in parks, for the inlaid paths must be kept free of dust. The vacuum cleaner will naturally be needed as an insect exterminator. It is absolutely horrifying that today it is still not used for this purpose. That the vacuum cleaner has already been employed for getting rid of street dust, I take to be a known fact.
I think it strikes me that what he's talking about when he means dust is he's euphemistically talking about horse shit.
Okay, I didn't get that. That makes sense. Do you want another one? 44. Vanquishing vermin. That in a glass house, if properly built, vermin must be unknown, needs no further comment.
Yeah, he's got a big thing about how bricks breed fungus.
They're very funny. There's this wonderful. I think you do find yourself remembering that he was drunk most of the time, although being like quite productive.
Oh, there's two. These are just some of these are just too good to be too good to be missed out on. Transportable buildings. Transportable glass buildings can as well be produced. They are particularly suitable for an exhibition purpose. Transportable buildings of this type are not easy to make. But one must not forget that in a new movement, the most difficult step is the first. Mad. That wasn't even the one I was looking for. Oh, wow. Metal filigree with an enamel inlay hung in front of a crude reinforced concrete. Many experiments could be imagined. Filigree ornament with enamel inlay is perhaps worth considering. It would look like a piece of jewellery on a large scale. Much of glass architecture concerns the jeweller. For the time being, ladies are not going to allow this, because they are afraid of losing their share of adornment.
Yes, ladies, always holding back. Always holding back progress.
Normally, we look for the scandalous and ridiculous sections of a book to point them out, because we like the scandalous and ridiculous. There is no need to point out the scandalous and ridiculous sections of this book, because the entire thing is scandalous and ridiculous.
It hangs together around a set of ideas, which he holds very deeply, which are about the effect of coloured glass on the senses and on the mind and on the kind of the soul. So, 90. The nervous effect of very bright light unsoftened by colour. We have to thank very bright lights, in part, for the nervous ailments of our time. Light softened by colour calms the nerves. In many sanatoria, it is recommended by nerve doctors as beneficial.
Yes, that's a point sandwiched between one about how bricks cause disease and how railway stations should be made of coloured screens.
Well, I think we're slightly in danger of, like, the vision is the transformation of society. It's that everyone is, when these buildings are become so beautiful, like, every experience is like being inside the kind of this sort of wonder of, like, a stained glass window. When everything is so beautiful, everyone will be happy all the time. We'll be transformed into better people.
It's a world of delirious pleasure of kaleidoscopes. Yeah. Which is going to be... I'm not going to read the whole one out because it's long on the door. But the doors... Everyone's doors are going to be self-opening with push panels. So that you can push a panel in the floor and open the door for your guests. Yeah. And that motion will be accompanied with spinning... coloured crystals and transparent planes of glass sliding around to create the effect of a liveried flunky.
He is a little bit like an 8-year-old girl, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's a world that, if it was built, you could use it as a sort of My Little Pony set. But also, weird, it feels like it's something that was very influential on 60s sci-fi, where there's a lot of people with crystals.
He believes in this very fundamental way that beauty is sort of ennobling.
But it's also a very special kind of beauty. He forbids use of human and animal forms. He forbids imagery, for the most part, except possibly of a few kinds of plants.
Yeah.
He forbids anything solid. For the most part, he's very frightened of the idea of mirrors. Basically, everything must be coloured glass, and everything else is sinister.
Yeah, well, you know, no, you're allowed other, like, reflective... There's lots of niello and enamel and things.
The mercury of mirrors is like a poison. Avoidance of quicksilver and the effects of mirrors. The dangers of Tiffany effects must not wholly be ignored. They are not only dangerous, after all, in inartistic hands. One should only allow quicksilver effects in mirrors. A utilitarian existence in the dressing room. And it goes on to say how mirrors are... Quicksilver mirrors are like the poison that they're made from.
For all the, like, we could go on a long time with all the absurd bits, and maybe we'll find a few more, but, like...
The absurd bits. Can you find some unabsurd bits?
No.
But, I mean, you read it, and you're charmed.
It's utterly
charming. I would recommend
people
to read it, although it is almost impossible to get hold of.
One of the things which is very attractive about it is that, you know, the whole world is united and together, and there are these, like, beautiful cities all over the world... And everyone is kind of delighting in it. There is no exploitation. Although I think in a way, like, everyone is sort of has their, like, little bourgeois house. It's not like we're all going to live in a big glass hive.
In fact, there's one that's a bit... let me find it. It's called something like...
Let me do one on the transformation of the Earth's surface. 102. The transformation of the Earth's surface. So many ideas constantly sound to us like a fairy tale, when they are not really fantastic or utopian at all. 80 years ago, the steam railway came and undeniably transformed the face of the Earth. From what has been said so far, the Earth's surface will once again be transformed, this time by glass architecture. If it comes, a metamorphosis will occur.
I found my one. 105. A composed and settled nation when glass architecture comes. When home life has reached the stage when even the wildest fancies can appear to be realised, the longing for something different ceases. People will only travel to learn about a particular type of glass art and the possibility to bring it home. Perhaps somewhere one may discover the art of making glass fibres like brocades. And then he goes off onto another, like, spiel about glass fibre for the remainder of the section. But the point that the world will become settled when it has experienced its wildest fancies and everyone will live in a calm and harmonious society.
Everyone's at peace, yeah.
That's a rare articulation.
Yes, it's a bit like, what we need is for all the FBI to take acid, like, you know, that kind of like hippie demand. Or what we need is to get J. Edgar Hoover to do acid, and then, like, we'll, you know, it's the it. Everyone is at a kind of ecstatic peace. So this is a thing which lots of people have done, but to conceive of it in architectural terms is what makes this really sort of special and strange.
But also that everyone's flights of fancy will be just having coloured glass everywhere. Yeah. All your furniture, which must all be made of glass, must be in the middle, and all chairs must be facing outward to look at the glass walls.
The meeting between the two personalities, Tout and Scherbart, were both involved with a magazine called Der Sturm, which is a sort of radical publication. When they met, Scherbart already had this plan to create a society of glass architects, but Tout took it up, and they obviously became very, very close friends very quickly.
And also very helpful, because Tout was already an established architect. He's a feverish operator, a really good organiser. All these sort of magazines and enterprises all centre around him, and he gets all that stuff going. Scherbart, charismatic, people loved him, certain sort of person, couldn't organise or put together anything.
No, he couldn't run a bath, yeah.
Yeah, and that enables this sort of, this annus mirabilis, this sort of creative fulmination between the two of them. And also Tout is able to realise some of these mad... He's able to take that manifesto and make things out of it, which is...
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing. He makes the double wall. He makes the glittering water and the kaleidoscopic light. Also the furniture in the centre and the outward-facing wall. He might not, as predicted by Scherbart, make the building mobile initially, but sometimes perhaps... The first thing is not the most difficult.
And although the glass house, which we started with, is actually a collaboration in more ways than one, it's dedicated to Scherbart, it's inspired by his architectural kind of agenda and proposals, but it also is encircled by these little epigrams which are written by Scherbart. He is the poet whose words encircle the outside of the dome.
I think we should say we started with our person, our character, approaching and seeing these slogans. And we sort of read them in translation. In the original German, they're very jaunty. Yeah.
I want to do... I've tried this a couple of times, and I rely on you having slightly forgotten some of the information. I quite like to try the glass slogans quiz.
Oh, God. The answer is usually not ferrocement.
So, I'm going to supply the first half, and you're going to supply what you think is the second half.
Oh, God. It's even more... Yeah, this is going to be impossible.
Coloured glass destroys hatred.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I've been trying to rewrite them in the crystal... In the crystal palace, there is no malice.
Greater than the diamond.
Yeah, but this is going to be just like last time. I can't remember anything. Because they don't rhyme... In English, it's impossible to do them.
Do you give up?
Greater than the diamonds. It's got it. Rhyme, the double glass ball
is the double glass ball. Yes.
Yeah. But they don't. But I mean, the really important thing about them is that they're jingles.
Yes.
Is that they're jaunty jingles?
Yeah.
And greater than the diamonds is the double glazed wall. Isn't a jingle?
Okay, I'll try and do it in my best German. Größer als der Diamant ist die doppelte Glashauswand.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, or the earlier one.
It rhymes, therefore it must be true.
Das,
quality to them.
Das bunte Glas zerstört den Hass. Or you want? How about this one? Flammable materials
are an absolute travesty or something.
Yes, absolute scandal. This is good. You're good at it. So it's essentially like vermin is bad.
Coloured glass is good?
Yeah. No. But it's unknown in the glass house or something. I can't remember what the English translation of this one is. Das Ungeziefer ist nicht fein. Ins Glashaus kommt es niemals rein.
Mm.
Yep. Okay, one more. Oh, but that's not really translatable. It's like, the happiness of colours only...
In glass? What is it?
I don't know. In the glass culture.
In the glass culture, yeah, in glass culture. I suppose we have mentioned why it's glass. Because, I mean, we haven't talked about the Gothic Cathedral and Saint-Chapelle. If you go to Paris, you get the extreme end where it's the Gothic chapel is trying to be entirely coloured glass.
Yeah.
And the light inside glows with colour. And he takes that, and he's got the idea of this paradise in the palm house, which makes a great deal of sense to me. As a child, it feels like paradise.
Yeah.
Because of you walk from the horrible outside into the warm, humid, tropical interior.
And there is this extraordinary kind of softness and peace inside the palm houses because there's so many kind of absorbent plant-like surfaces. It's so full.
And also the transformation from in to out is so amazing. One of the funny things in is he's sort of, in his glass, trying to dissolve interiority. He talks about making the outside much more like the interior and the interior a bit more like the outside with the glass wall you're in the garden. And vice versa, and outside is going to be free of vermin and insects because they're all going to be exterminated by giant vacuum cleaners. And the mountain is going to be like the inside because it's going to be illuminated by a chain of franchised hotels.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful, brightly coloured.
Hotels. All these hotels that will illuminate with flashlights the mountain.
This we have alluded to this, but this is the strange tension in... the Glass Architecture Manifesto is that it is at one side of it is this like extraordinarily daring, bonkers vision for the complete transformation of the world, but he's trying to think through like a few practical steps to get us there. Like, how might we destroy the reputation of bricks? How might we,
for example, the new aerial torpedo from our Zeppelins? A brick building struck by the aerial torpedo could collapse. Whereas, as long as the glass tower is supported by at least 4 steel piers, they will merely be bent by the aerial torpedo.
And he thinks that, like, it, you know, obviously the loss of life would be deplorable, but it might be a good thing for the hastening the decline of brick culture.
Mm. Along with the fact that bricks are full of lice and bacteria.
Yeah. But he's, you know, also things like, what's the smallest concrete step that we might make towards... the establishment of a glass architecture? Well, maybe you could add like an amazing veranda to your house.
Basically conservatories.
Yeah, it's very odd though, like he's thinking through, you know, how the skirting's gonna be, what the furniture is like.
And
you
at
know,
the same time, there's also some very strange ones. There's one that is for anyone who does not believe in the significance and importance of glass. People have said it is just a children's plaything, but the Doppler effect allows us to examine the distance and speed of passing stars because of the compressive effect on the wavelengths of light. This proves that glass is a most serious substance. This doesn't make any sense. This is really strange thought process of justification.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of all embracing.
And they come one immediately after another. Like, they're in these... It's a numbered list that has no... How do you think he wrote it? What do you think he's writing? Do you think he wrote it in one go?
I think he wrote it in one go, all the way through, bashing it out on the...
Because he says the same thing over and over again. He talks about fiberglass. A lot of them are talking about glass fibers, and a lot of them are talking about different building... Oh, and halls of gathering and the buildings of sports societies could be greatly benefited from glass walls. They are being put up all over our country. Oh, lighthouses... It is a travesty that lighthouses are made of bricks, as bricks are so heavy, and they are often put on prominent outcrops. Glass and steel would be much lighter and consequently more practical. It's about wonder. But a really cosy, simple kind of wonder. And also, it's a society that I think is essentially the same. He doesn't have any political problems... or no major ones. It's still capitalism. It's going to be a capitalist world. There's still going to be rich people and poor
people. I think
people.
Everyone's going to be an artist. I mean,
I think everyone's going to be an art consumer.
It's a capitalism where everybody is a bourgeois.
I'm very happy we did this. So we've had quite a few stabs at doing this episode. This is one of the What, this was one of the least bad Lost episodes. But now we've done it after we've dealt with the dystopias and Zamyatin's We, which was only written a few years, 4 years, 5 years afterwards, though they were fairly active years for the continent of Europe. Zamyatin's clear, prismatic cage and the sort of weird, satirized, self-satirized tyranny of his glass architecture. I mean, Zamyatin's glass is all clear, but there is something in the time in the future being completely transparent. And glass is a material which has got a lot of contradictions in it. It's hard, it's modern, it's playful, it's transparent. Transparency is a complex thing because it allows you to experience the world and beauty around you, and it allows you to observe and control. It is at once the Gothic window and the microscope, the camera lens. And he sort of, that's a bit like what he's dealing with when he says the Doppler effect. He's sort of alluding to, it is also the material of science. Glass, beakers and flasks, and lenses, analytical systems. But he never wants to deal with sort of science and industry. And he even says industrial buildings, it is understood that industrial buildings couldn't be made of glass, but we could at least address the concrete in enamelware. And they're both involved in the complexity of the meaning of this substance, but don't want to take on what were even then its sort of applications. He talks about transparency and he never talks about surveillance. It's natural for him not to deal with things because he's a delirious holy fool, but there is a choice there in a way. And if you're thinking about glass is an amazing material, and I'm sure we will talk about it more, but it's a difficult thing to talk about because it can mean so many things in so many different circumstances. Something that can be children's play. Tout, in one of his accompaniments, letter he wrote in accompaniment to the Crystal Palace, talks about how we will win over the future generation with indestructible coloured glass blocks, which will be their playthings. And once they play, instead of with wooden blocks, with colourful glass blocks, they will make the future paradise.
Well, they had a lot of ideas about the future, but they didn't really see where it was going. And we're not going to talk about that now, but something is about to happen. The world is going to change. But the glass dream is not quite going to end, although it's going to take on a very different form. So we'll save that for the next episode. Thanks very much, George.
Till next time.
Till next time.
Bye.
Till next time. Zum nächsten Mal.
Zum nächsten Mal.
On the banks of the Rhine with a sign, sung by Collins and Harlan at a Sun Record.
We thank you. You know, we have been looking at the graph of people downloading our episode, so we know you exist.
Alpine, such as it is.
Yes. And we'd love to hear from you, so do drop us an email at aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com.
Tell us what you think. We're still in the working out, and this is applies probably even to people we know, who at the moment still constitute the majority of the audience. We really are trying to work out what we should do and have a sort of external look and so we can think about it properly.
Yeah, and we're both like very clearly sort of intellectual dilettantes, so if we've got something really wrong, we'd like to hear that too. Be interesting. And I think that we're potentially, we'd love to kind of have a conversation about the stuff that we're talking about with you. Is there a glass? Yes, glass greetings. Until next time.
Sit beside the stream on the banks of the Rhine with a good old friend. Do, sit with me on the banks of the Rhine with a sign. Where the Frankfurt tree grows so fine.
On shower, shower. Louis, bring the sauerkraut.
Yeah, yeah, smoke a cigar and the world will be just yours and mine.
So come, dream, sit beside the stream
on the banks of the Rhine with a good old bank.